Accession number 28625, Rail 4.
Good morning, Mr. Strachan.
Good morning.
Last time we were speaking, we spoke about the Independence Day Parade at Zanzibar, which I believe was in December 1963.
Yes.
And then we were also speaking about the problems in Africa with the mutinies and things that went on. But I did see an article, and it was about some lion cubs that had belonged to the Scots Guards that the Gordon Highlanders borrowed. Could you tell us about that, please?
We had a very healthy relationship between the Second Battalion and the Scots Guards and ourselves, and we played various sports against them, had various visits with them, to them, from them, and I've no idea why specifically did they go for the cubs. The two cubs had been given to them, and I think were connected to the film that had been made about the cubs. And however, we had a deputation which one Saturday night felt should travel 75 miles down to the barracks in Nairobi and pinch the cubs and return 75 miles back up to Gilgal. And lovely cubs. Everybody wanted to hold them and whatever. And so they waddled about in the sand's nest, whittling at every chair or so. And the master tailor was in the mess that night. We decided that he should have a bit of tartan, Gordon tartan. So he went off and made two tartan belts for them. And I've now got it. It was Wireless for the Blind. And it was a radio program through the BFDS, the British Forces Radio. And you could pledge money for this if something happened, or play the tune or something of that nature. So our lads had come back with the cubs and had then gone to the phone to the radio station saying, tell the jockards, we have got the cubs, and if they pledge X amount, then we'll return them. And that really is a story. And eventually, they accepted all this, and they came and collected the cubs. And their colonel, by the name of Ramsey, a proper gentleman, came into the mess and said, well done, that's one up on you, and bought us a drink.
So did they do anything back to the Gordons to give
you? No, it was... It was well received. As I say, we had a tremendous relationship with them.
And did the Gordons have anything? I think he mentioned off record that these cubs had been presented to them. Did the Gordons ever get anything presented to them from the locals or anything?
Not that I can recall. I mean, they were a much more civilised barrack down in Nairobi, whereas we were up in the highlands 6,000 feet up. With just a village sort of community that would rather pinch from you than present to you.
And with the cubs as well, did your children see them?
Yes, they're still there the following day, and lots of people from them, yeah.
And was it a secret, or did they, you know, was it...
No, we kept it very open.
Okay. And I was also reading about like football games at New Year and that. Is that how you celebrated New Year when you were up at Gilgal?
Yes, that's a variety of things that you do to retain some of the customs and the feelings of family life. And the officers always play the sergeant, and the corporals would play the sergeant and so on. What a mixture.
And whilst you were in Kenya as well, did you get holidays? I know you spoke about that you went out, you know, you bought an old car and you went out and about. Did you actually get leave when you were out there?
You could get local leave, which most people did do. And off you'd go in your car to different places, and you would think nothing of travelling 100 miles to see something.
Okay. So... I believe that you started to come back in the early part of 1964, did you?
Yes, back to Redford Barracks in Edinburgh. Mm-hmm.
And was there another regiment replacing you up at Gilgal?
There must have been, but I kind of distance and track on that. I'm sorry.
Okay. The reason I was asking was actually about your car. I remember you said that you got a car and you drove about. And I was wondering what you'd done with that. You know, I wondered if you sold
it. The local people were too keen to offer you some token for it rather than leave it lying there. Most people had old bangers. So.
Okay. And were you still in the job where, like, when the regiment was leaving, that you had to, like, organise all the supplies and things that you had?
By this time, I was a company sergeant major, a warrant officer class 2, and my job spectrum was quite different from when I first went there. I was more into the management of men and materialistic things.
And had you to apply for that position?
No, no, no. That was all these promotions are based upon your ability and recommendation by the people whom you work for.
And had you? I know that you said earlier in your army career that you had to study, you know, whilst you progressed up the career ladder. Uh-huh. Was there any more qualifications that you needed for this role?
No, I did my educational requirement, which allowed me to be promoted to warrant officer.
And so how did your job differ? Were you now more dealing with the men?
Yes, as a company sergeant major, but I went to headquarter company, and you had a mixture of signal platoon and motor transport and cooks and different people like that. Different departments, so you had to coordinate them. You're still responsible for the training, the drill, the discipline, and the administration as such.
And the training the headquarter company, was that still at Gilgil?
Yes, all together. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so were you having to actually now look at how you trained men? Was this part, you know, was it more like a programme of training and...
Each department was a specialist group in their own way. Therefore, they would look after the instruction and the quality of that particular department. But it's the overall scene. I was more distant from them in a sense, and still responsible for coordinating situations and systems.
And were you happy about this promotion?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Quite happy.
And was there any other benefits? Like, did you maybe get like better housing or better conditions? Or
No. Nothing at all.
Nothing?
No, it's just the way that the army works. You put in and you get out. But there is a standard which is acceptable to all. No, it's just another rung on the ladder as far as I'm concerned.
And who would have been your line manager? You know how nowadays they speak about line manager?
Uh-huh.
Who would have been the one in command above you?
Was a major.
Okay.
One of the senior majors.
So when it, you know, when it came to the end of your time at Gilgil, where before you would have had to look after the supplies, what had you now to do for coming back to Redford Barracks?
Well, you had to... be informative to all the departments of how you travel, when you would travel, how when you got there, were you entitled to leave, and you'd find a train time and specific dates of departure and return, and who would be left to sort of look after the sort of home fires, keep them burning as well. And you would make sure that things happened in accordance with the program.
So that sounds quite a big job, actually. You know, when you think of was it the whole regiment that were out there?
No, I was looking after one particular company, which perhaps was 150, 169.
Okay, and so how did you get back to Britain? Was it by ship again, or
we flew back as a family? Certain families on your plane would be a mixture of men, women and children, a balance, an equal amount.
And so was that from Nairobi that you flew?
Yes.
And was it a direct flight or?
Direct flight to Edinburgh.
Was it an RAF one or was it
a civilian firm who were contracted to the Ministry of Defence to move?
And I know that you'd flown before, obviously, because you'd been in different locations, but in 1964, it seems, you know, how did your family take flying all that distance from Africa?
No problem. No problem. In fact, I distinctly remember the minister who was in the same, and the padre who was in the same flight as us, and we saw him on his hands and knees, and we asked him, well, nearer to God are we, but you know, is there any problem? And he said, no, he'd lost one of his studs. Well, it's quite a nice way to travel.
And did you have furniture and things out in the Gilgil? Did that have to come back?
No, not as far as we were concerned. We were, each house had its inventory that I already mentioned, and you just made sure you handed it over.
Okay. And did you get some leave when you first came back?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so you went to Redford Barracks, and that was in 1964.
Uh-huh.
Did you have family accommodation there?
Yes, we did. We had a house in Draghon Garden, near Draghon Barracks.
Was that far from?
No, you could walk to work.
And were you still continuing the same type of work that you had?
Same job, yes. Mm-hmm.
And what was the purpose of being at Redford Barracks? What were you actually doing there?
Well, we were due to go to Bisley to act as the administrative unit for all the shooting that the army had annually. That was quite a commitment. And then we were due to go to Borneo in February next year, so we were obviously preparing for that as well. And in between time, doing various courses and bringing everybody up to speed, as it were, whatever their particular job was. I in particular, went off to a drill course with the guards down in Pembright. And then when I came back from that, I went and looked after things at Bisley, making sure that people were assembled in time and marched their various responsibilities throughout each day. And then back we came to Redford Barracks.
And I know you've been at Redford Barracks before. Was the accommodation and the building itself, had it changed in any way? Or?
No, very, very little.
Okay, so it's still the same way. And you spoke about men going on courses. Was that part of your responsibility to make sure that the men in your company had the correct courses?
All courses are run and coordinated by the second command of the battalion, so it's an area responsibility. And if you have individuals who are in need of upgrading, then you would put the recommendations to the second command in the order room, and they would make arrangements for them to attend the course. So it was a centrally controlled system.
Okay. And you spoke about going on a drill course. Was it to a place called Pembright?
No, Pembright.
Oh, Pembright, sorry. And your drill was obviously very good because you had organised, you know, some of the Independence Day parades and mm-hmm, things. Mm-hmm. So what more were you doing on this course? Because your drill must have been a very high standard.
Well, obviously, I think it was because I got an A grade in, and that's the first A grade in the curriculum that I've had for many, many moons. It just meant that you were much more aware of the detail of certain aspects of it and were able to interpret it and to produce a better balanced standard. And I was lucky in that I'd been an instructor at Sandhurst, training officer, so I had a very good base foundation from that.
And you said that you took guards with you. Did you take a lot of men with you? You know, were a lot of men on this drill course with you?
There was five of us.
And would you have been drilling the officers after that as well?
Yes, I did. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it was like all ranks that you drilled?
Yes, all ranks. In fact, we had, at that particular time, quite a bit of ceremonial to look forward to, in that the Queen arriving at the Waverley Station, the Queen arriving at Holyrood Palace, there was the opening of the Fourth Road Bridge, and we had to provide guard of honour for all of that.
And when you say a guard of honour, how many men would have been?
96 plus officers. And that was quite a lot.
What would have been your role in that? Were you organising this drill for?
My job was that to train them. Each company would provide the men. They would have that responsibility. And I would assemble them and train them. And then they would go off and do it. And we'd also have the Church of Scotland Assembly. We'd provide a guard of honour for that. In fact, I do remember lots of guards of honour.
And if... Was it actually in Redford Barracks that you would do the training?
Yes, on the square and the barracks. Yeah.
And did you ever go out on the these occasions and, you know, with them as part of the...
Only as a spectator. I would be much in the background. My job was to produce the goods and the fluency of it and the accuracy of it, and then hope that those appointed to conduct the trade would do so properly.
And did you not feel... I don't mean disappointed, but, you know, after doing all of this work with them, did you not want to actually be in there with them?
In a sense, yes. But, I mean, if you consider that I was on a ladder that was moving up, and the next step to that was the regimental sergeant major, which I'd won the army to be. All of this was an apprenticeship, and one that I was very enthusiastic about. And keen that I could pursue every little avenue that would improve me.
And when you spoke about the likes of the Fourth Road Bridge opening as well, where about did they actually do the parade for that?
At the edge of the bridge, at the end of it, the Edinburgh end.
And was the Queen there that day?
Uh-huh.
And was it impressive?
Well, all of these parades I find impressive, colourful, and exacting.
And was it the same type of drill that you did every time, or is there variations that you can do in this drill?
I would say all the same, really. It's a basic standardised form, but it would be modified slightly to suit the circumstances.
And for, you know, you've spoken about the Church of Scotland Assembly, Fourth Road Bridge, I believe Holyrood House and
Bridge. Yes, that was from the Queen coming there, yeah. Uh-huh.
Each time you had to train for something like this, I don't mean you, but you trained the men. How long would you have expected to actually be training them for? Would it have been like a week beforehand or something?
Well, more, really, but not necessarily every day. Many, many other things take place which you cannot forget about. So you just plan the thing that fit into the jigsaw. And hopefully you get the same amount of men each time that they assembled. But, I mean, you've got to make provision for people going on courses, people sick and leave, and people in hospital, etc., etc.
And would it have generally been the same men that you were using, apart from, as you say, you know, when they couldn't manage?
Yes, predominantly.
And would it have been quite an honour to have been selected as well for this?
I think so.
Okay. And was there ever occasions when you were up at the castle, you know, maybe like the tattoo or anything?
I've never involved with the tattoo. I've watched it, but never been part of it.
Okay then. And you also mentioned, was it the, is it Bisley?
Bisley, uh-huh. Yeah.
The rifle shooting down there.
Mm-hmm.
So were you part of that as
yes,
well?
Yes, as I mentioned, my responsibility was assembling people every day and making sure that they got to the different ranges on time and the correct amount of people. And just maintaining that sort of aspect of attendance.
And were there many ranges?
Oh yes, I mean with the sentry range at 100 targets in one. So you can imagine you required at least 200 people to mark the target in addition to the various other ranges. So yes, that's quite a... In fact, we were reinforced by 100-odd Cameroonians in addition to the Golan Heather.
And is this an army area, this rifle?
It's a civilian organisation, but the armed forces use it for this annual occasion.
And were you shooting in it?
No.
Just purely helping the...
Indeed, doing the more administrative stuff.
Yeah. And so is it like inside or is it outside?
Outside. Mm-hmm. All of it. Huge. You can imagine, as I say, 100 targets.
And is it in moorland or something like that?
No. Well, it's just rural countryside, really.
And does it not upset the locals' routine or anything?
I don't think so, no. It improved a lot by whatever we spent. So. And it was an acceptable annual competition.
So how many days would this be over?
Certainly a month, a few weeks, a month.
So quite a long time.
Oh, yes.
It was things like, I thought, the extra vehicles and things on the road that, you know, would maybe cause some congestion.
No, I don't think so. It is, you know, you're within an area. You bear in mind that we had tented encampments and huts, etc. It's an area that's been used for many, many years.
And when you mentioned tents there, were these tents that you put up yourselves or were there?
No, they provided for you.
And you mentioned as well, you know, that for these 100
targets,
that you needed, was it two?
Two men, yeah. They were metal frames and into which you put 4-foot wooden targets. And there was a dual set, one in the front and one in the back. So each pair had to look after two targets, and you had to make sure for time competitions, for example, that all the front targets would go up together, and all the back ones would come down together, and so on. And then you had handheld wooden ones with a different figure of a man for other competitions, and that again would be done and timed up and down and so on. You had to have a very well-coordinated group of people responding to a command or a blast of a whistle.
And was it quite exciting?
I would say that the jocks found it rather boring after a few hours, but it was novel, it was something different, and you had to sustain that enthusiasm. It was more difficult for those in command, I think, to encourage.
Whereabouts is this area? Is it in England? Or?
Yes, in the southern part of England. Yeah.
And was it the type of event that there would maybe be bets placed on or anything?
No, I have no idea.
You weren't involved in that?
No.
And was your wife still in Edinburgh at this point?
Mm-hmm.
So it was only the soldiers who would be there? And with being in this tented accommodation as well, was there showers and everything there?
You had to move for your showers and latrines, yeah. But being fine weather, you accepted that.
Okay. And then did you go back to Edinburgh after that?
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. I read in the book that there was a recruiting drive on as well. Were you involved with that now, or had you moved on?
No, I wasn't involved in that one.
Okay. And I believe the finish of National Service must have been round about that time, was it? Was it the early 60s that National Service finished?
62?
Was it? Was it I wondered if it had been difficult to actually get men in after that, or was it still quite
easy? No, it was still as fluent as ever.
Okay. And I also saw that, did the Gordons go to Otterburn? Did you?
I wasn't involved in that, but yes, we could well have gone to that and performed some training, and it was there that you could do live firing and fire mortars and anti-tank guns, for example, one of the few areas in Britain where you can do so.
Mm-hmm. And I heard you saying that you were going to Borneo in February 65.
Yes.
Was there trouble brewing in Borneo?
Yes.
And had you known for a while that you were going there, or was this...
Yes, we had. Uh-huh. The trouble had been ongoing between Indonesia and their borderline, and Sukarno had been wanting to pinch him over, and he was being quite a nuisance, so... We had to go to certain points in this border situation and patrol and look after things in general.
Okay. So do you remember when you first heard that you would be going to Borneo?
I think that we'd been aware of this, certainly when we were in Kenya. It was part of the army plot. The army had a big plot which says which unit will go where and how and whatever. And we'd been aware of it, sadly, a year in advance.
It was quite a long time.
Oh, yeah.
And had you known anything about Borneo before that time?
Well, I had 3 years' experience in Malaya, so I'm very much aware that a jungle is a jungle, doesn't matter where it is. And terrorists behave similarly. So. With that experience behind me, I was well prepared for it.
And did you know that it was going to be jungle type warfare again?
Yes, we did. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And did they prepare you within this year? Was there any more preparation they did or anything?
Well, what we sent an advance party out to the northwestern part to Kota Balud. And that's a training camp, and we would stay at that training camp for a month.
Okay, but before you went out, there wasn't...
Well, yes, you'd attend lectures and see films, and you would build up, as it were, whatever you possibly could, but the only realism you could get is by waiting until you got there and to see the situation. And the conditions.
And was there much in the British press about maybe the political situation out there?
Oh, I think so. I mean, for instance, the confrontation was along a 1,000-mile border, and we had many troops supporting the Malayan forces and dealing and containing it.
Okay. And did your wife go out there with you?
No. No, it was unaccompanied.
And so did your wife stay in Edinburgh?
Stayed in Edinburgh, continued schooling of the children, and yes.
And how old were your children by this stage? I think it's 1964, is it?
64. One had been 9, 7 and 5.
And did they go to the local schools?
Yes.
In Edinburgh? Oh, uh-huh. It wasn't an army school?
No. We were a normal civilianised situation.
Okay, so when you left Britain to go to Borneo, how did you manage to travel out there?
We flew from Edinburgh and flew to Singapore, changed planes and then flew into Labuan, I think it was. We went to Borneo and then from there in trucks up the hill and eventually getting to Kota Balud, the training camp.
And was this an RAF flight or was it a civilian one?
Again, on contract, civilian.
Okay. And would you have been travelling in uniform or in civilian?
In civilian.
And did you have your kit with you?
Yes, all my kit with me.
And were you issued with like a tropical kit?
Mm-hmm.
And what does that consist of?
It's just a light weight cotton shorts and trousers and jacket shirt type thing.